1 2 1 2.
Resilience. A life in care.
Actually, turn these off.
Oh, phones, yeah.
A personal podcast series by Tony Simpson.
Do you know roughly what you want to talk about?
Very roughly.
Episode 4.
You know, when I knew this was happening, I kind of asked myself the same question. Why did I bring Tony home? He was the only black child within a radius of probably about 30 miles then. And to this day, I still don't know.
They were almost in awe of him sometimes, you know, because he stood out.
But then, as a child, I didn't see him any different than me.
It was quite a miserable time, actually. I think time just dragged on at Wildmoor Road. Days just dragged on.
It was so difficult trying to be all things to all men. Whatever I had to be to you and whatever you needed me to be, there were 9 others waiting for me to be that to them as well.
It was just transitory, to be honest, Paul, in those days. So everything I did, I'd never think more than 6 months to a year ahead. I never invest emotionally in anything. And I can remember that. And I can remember sort of just turning off emotionally. Welcome to this, the fourth instalment in my podcast series, where I'm going back over my life in care. It's all part of Bernardo's Oral History Project, which is capturing and sharing the experiences of the Windrush generation and their descendants. If you caught the previous episodes of my story, you'll know that I was born in a Salvation Army hostel, and you'll have heard that I was just 3 months old when I entered the care of Bernardo's. And also, you'll be aware of the trauma I went through when I moved to a radically different care facility on a council estate in Shirley, Solihull. I was just 6 years old when I moved to Wildmoor Road.
OK, Tony, so in this programme, we're still talking about Wildmoor Road, but we're also going to talk about...
Senior school,
secondary school.
Yeah.
And I think we'll use as a starting point some of the papers that we have from your records that Bernardo's have given you.
Yeah. That's Paul, my friend and companion in this journey, and as luck would have it, a radio producer. He's been working through my paperwork from Bernardo's, something I've been reluctant to do myself.
This is annual review form of child in residential care, as it says in the headed notepaper, and the date of the review is 18th of December 1972.
Child had been 12?
No, 11.
Sorry, 11, yeah.
What it says is, at initial level, offers all he has, but little left to sustain relationships effort. Constantly in need of a one-to-one relationship and thus at disadvantage in a group living situation. Has become markedly withdrawn and quiet since change to senior school. Does that sound like you?
It does, yeah.
Markedly withdrawn?
Yeah, I was.
Quiet since the changes to senior school?
Yeah, I was then, yeah.
And that was for several
years.
Years.
Yeah. If I could have pushed a fast forward button, I would have done it. It was just, as I keep describing it, it's just a grey time. But I think that grey time helped formulate who I am and the ideas I've got now. I became very good at assessing people and situations. I was just a deep thinker, actually. I just used to think a lot. I had nothing else to do, just think. Throughout my life, I've struggled with the legacy of my time in care, but it's also shaped me in good ways as well as bad. And that's why I'm making this podcast series. It's not that I have any of the answers. I just hope that confronting my own past and sharing my journey as honestly as possible, it helps others and shows that such experiences can be used as a tool to bring about positive change.
I always tried to instill into them some sort of, you know, you're not the only thing on the planet, get on with it, type of attitude.
Jill Harrison, the house mother at Wildmoor Road, for much of my time there.
And I think that's always been Tony's sort of philosophy. I'm here, this is a situation, I've got to get on with it. So you get on with it.
Jill came into my life in 1971, and to enjoy her no-nonsense charm, I took Paul to North Yorkshire to meet her. You know, as I said to Paul on the way up here when we were coming to see you, You, for me, were probably the most important people in my life, actually, in as much that you gave me the you're pretty straightforward and you're pretty blunt. You said to me, what's your life? And I said, well, for me, and you should take this as a compliment, by the way, I said, she's a bit like a female Brian Clough. In as much that you had to get me from A to B.
Yeah.
You didn't have the emotional luxury of getting involved like you would do. I had to have the tools to get me from where I was to where I was going to get to. And then you would hope, once you got me to there, that I'd be able to move on. Is that fair?
Carry on. Yeah. Yeah. It was so difficult trying to be all things to all men. Whatever I had to be to you and whatever you needed me to be, there were nine others waiting for me to be that to them as well.
Mm. Do you remember what an average day would be like? Just explain to somebody listening to this what would happen from when we got up to went to bed. How would we have got up? Would we have got ourselves up? Would there have been a bell?
No. I would have got you up.
Okay. You get out of bed and you make your bed with hospital corners. So I learned how to do that. I could still do it to this day. You know, it had to be precision, bum, 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 made your bed, pillows, everything on, tidied up your side room table. It's like you're being inspected.
I insisted that things like that were done properly because they're important.
They are.
And, you know, if some lad or kid had just thrown the sheets on and thought, oh, I'll get in the heap, it doesn't matter, wasn't acceptable.
For the children who couldn't make them as well as me, would they...
I stripped it.
Correct, you did.
And they had it again, to do it again.
Correct.
And I stripped it, and they had to do it again.
Then you queue to the bathroom, and then depending on who's doing what, you'll have different jobs to do for breakfast.
You took it in turns to lay the table, do the washing up, drying up,
yeah,
and all of that.
Or doing the shoes, so you'd be outside on the wall polishing everyone's shoes, ready for school, or whatever. After that, you'd have your breakfast, wash up, and then you'd have malt or barley, a teaspoon of malt from a big jar, or barley, and then you would put your coat and stuff on and off you go to school.
But, I mean, I did the washing and the ironing and the same as any other parent would have done, I suppose. All of those things.
I remember when I left the home, it's really interesting, going to somebody's house and they asked me to make a cup of tea. And I put a tea bag in the kettle because I didn't know how you made tea. So it wasn't like a normal home in as much as I'd never, ever had access to making a cup of tea. So.
No, because that would always have been made for you. It appeared on the table, didn't it? So
yeah.
It wasn't normal in that way, I suppose.
When it came back, it would be probably reverse of all of that. But there was never any homework done. That's another thing. There was never a sense of somebody coming back saying, have you got any homework today? I don't think anybody ever asked me to do any homework. So I go back to school with my books next day and people give me homework in. And I just be like, my default was just excuses why I haven't done any homework. It was never thought I'd do some. I didn't know where I would do it. And there was never a slot in the day for me to sit down on a table and do homework. It was just not part of our culture. So in the end, I think teachers stopped asking me for homework.
But I know when we had some new kids come in, I can hear you saying it now. Tony said to these kids, there aren't many rules in this house at all, but what there are have to be kept.
She trained me well.
There weren't many rules. I mean, if they went out of a night, if I said you have to be in by a certain time, then they had to be in by that time. And if not, there were consequences. There were always consequences. This was what I tried to teach them from being very young. Whatever you do in life, there is always a consequence. Might be a good one, might be a bad one, but there is always a consequence.
And then on weekends, funny enough, I preferred weekdays to weekends, so I had other kids to play with. At weekends, we would, God, if it was raining, I would just be sitting in all day. I used to draw, funny enough, I used to draw quite a lot when I was there, and we had a piano, I used to play that a bit. And have dinner, and that was it. Go to bed. And then Sunday, we go to church. And I was in the boys' brigade, so I got to, you know, learn to play the drums and wear the uniform and stuff. But it was that cycle for ages. That was our lives. And I think all of us were a little bit ashamed of it, to be honest. Yeah. That sense of shame came from a life lived as a Bernardo's child first and a human being second. Everything we did had to be planned, booked, logged, and then recorded in the ever-present paperwork. It was only at school that we could mix with other children and be ourselves. And having found my way at junior school, I then had to start and do it all over again at secondary school. And I struggled with that, as my records show.
There's a report here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try and see if you can, okay. If you want to read it. That first paragraph.
Okay, Tony's behaviour still gives cause for some concern, although it's difficult to pinpoint any behavioural problems as such. What year is this?
72? It's 1972.
Yeah, I'd be 11. Let me keep going. It is generally his don't care attitude and rather pointless habit of taking things that belong to other children. It felt that this could not be regarded as stealing as such, but could be a form of attention seeking or even of trying to get other children into trouble. For example, he took one of the girls' spelling lists and then joined in the search. When he was later found going up the stairs with it in his hand, he was quite unconcerned and could give no explanation why he'd taken it. Bloody hell, that's a bit disturbing. Concentration is poor and generally functions at a much lower age level, yeah, than he should. Tends to vie for attention with the young children. His behaviour tends to irritate the staff. For example, he will go out to school in plimsolls instead of his shoes, although he knows this is forbidden. When corrected, he shows little resentment and accepts correction in a docile manner. Interesting. It's really weird. Looking at this now, I can sort of feel I must have just turned off. I can sort of remember just, yeah. Do you know what I mean? Just nothing. I just think I just closed down for a bit. And I think school... I think, I haven't thought about it. I think I was probably disassociated for a bit because I think it was just a horrible place to be. Do you know what I mean? Living where I was, the fear of school, so I dealt with it in any way I could do by trying to minimise or mitigate any risk. And then coming home and just getting through every day or every week of the home, I was just surviving. I wasn't even surviving. I was just...
Getting through the day.
Yeah, it's getting through the day. I think I was hugely depressed, actually. Time to go back to Lighthall Secondary School. Much of it the same as when I was there, but also much of it quite different. Oh, so near, we can still have that there. Wow, it's quite smart now. Because we'd not pre-arranged our visit, those we spoke to at the school were unable to give us permission to record on the premises, which was fair enough, but it meant we needed to find somewhere outside the gates to record my memories.
Right, then you need to find somewhere to park.
Yeah, I don't know.
Just down here.
Yeah, so we've just actually been up to the Lighthall reception and actually into the school where we met the deputy head and the head's secretary, which was quite fortuitous. And whilst, you know, they told us we couldn't record here, we did have a long conversation with them about the school and a bit about its history and my time there as an ex-pupil. But, you know, coming here for me, it's interesting. I mean, two of the buildings are absolutely as I remember them. I can see the sports hall where, you know, I did a lot of my exercise. But then you've got the modern bit that was built after a fire, I guess, in the early 90s. It's a place where, you know, I came every day of those years, actually, until I left school. Even when I was boarded out, I was coming here every day from where I was living. So it was it was the one consistent, actually, for me, this school. You know, my love of football came from the school. We all loved Birmingham when I was here, and I guess that's one of the things that I've got here.
Well, you were about to say it was your anchor.
No, it's not there. I nearly said that, well, it was an anchor, really. When I think back about it, it didn't make me feel great about myself, if I'm really honest. It didn't make me feel great about myself because I don't think I was ever myself while I was at the school. I didn't really know what to expect at Lighthall. I was a member of the Boys' Brigade and I was quite an active member, I guess, in those days. I was a drummer, 35th Birmingham, there you go. So I knew some of the older boys who were at Lighthall. The problem I had was the older boys who were in the Boys' Brigade at Lighthall were nice, but they were quite churchy and nice people. Lighthall was quite a rough school, and so I knew pretty early on that they wouldn't be the people who could probably give me any protection if I needed it, because I was coming into a different world, really. And so at Lighthall, in the first and second years, it was a madhouse, really. Yeah.
Last time we talked a lot about you developing your sense of self,
yeah,
how was your self-confidence in terms of going into yet another new situation?
I was pretty insecure, and I think I was very needy. In one way, I was very mature, but in another way, I was emotionally very immature. I think I had a lot of energy and a need for attention. And so I must have been a nightmare to teach, actually. Looking back on it, I had the wind in my face in terms of life at that stage and with no shelter. So, you know, I had to deal with my teenage years, race, education, just knowing who I was in a very, you know, strange environment. I think in those days, if I could have not spoken to anybody and just read a book, I'd have rather done that than gone to school and had to be sociable.
But that's important. The being sociable, I imagine, yeah, might well have provided you with skills that you use in a later life. If you just stayed at home and just hid...
I think I'd quite like to have done that in those years, actually. I think there must have been a point where I just pivoted from being this child who was looking for something to being somebody who was going to just have to engage and be something else. By the time I was in my third year at senior school, I was totally different to everybody from, you know, the Boys' Brigade or other kids who I'd been friends with when I grew up. They probably thought I was quite rough, and rough in a way that I wasn't very refined. It's funny, when I think back to myself, I was a totally different person. I was quite rough. Making that transition from junior to senior school is something everybody struggles with. But for me, there were additional problems to overcome. I was the first black person to join that school, actually.
Were you the first one or the only one when you arrived? Or do you not know?
I was the only one when I arrived, and there were 5 years ahead of me, and there was no one black in the years ahead of me. By the time I left, there were about four or five in the whole school. Yeah, I think I was the first. And that is just about demographics and where the school was as well. So I had to prepare myself for a different kind of survival, really, which wasn't just becoming a teenager. I was becoming aware of race, and I was also becoming aware of class. You know, I was aware where we lived. I was now aware that we lived in the home and we didn't have the right clothes, because if you become a teenager, you get into the whole world of fashion. I remember once coming down from school and my shoes were so worn, people were laughing. I don't think we had regular, you know, school clothes. We had once a year. You know, I wanted to dress well, but we couldn't. And that creates a certain stoicism. Does that make sense? You sort of just think, oh, well. And so in other ways, I became more mainstream, just in my humour and the friendship groups I had.
But you also mentioned that it was the one constant.
No, it was. I mean, I was here all the way through.
And consistency is important.
Yeah, it was, but it wasn't a constant reinforced good things about myself. So I had some pretty damning reports when I was here, which were personal on my character. A report that starts at, you know, Tony's a typical West Indian, it doesn't make you feel good about yourself. In fact, I don't think I read the rest of the report. And also, you know, I think when I was here, this is a school where the most dominant teachers were the games teachers, and so that creates a culture that's not academic or learning. The school's job, I guess, is to educate, and I don't think I ever got an education when I was here. But then again, it's unfair to the school, because I don't think I was in an emotional state to receive one. I know my situation is complex, but I have school reports that describe my handwriting and my work as disgusting and pathetic. And there is one here that I want to quote directly from. Tony has a typical West Indian temperament. Charming, generally happy, but with little personal motivation as regards to work. There are no problems as regards discipline, and no problems as regards his colour. But he has little personal drive. That is from my form teacher. So it's no surprise that I don't look back on my time at Lytall with great fondness. I don't have many positive memories, really. I know I got slippered a lot and caned. I was quite sporty, as I said before. I wasn't ever bullied or anything like that. And I wasn't a bully myself. But I was friends with the people at the top end of the food chain.
I mean, it sounds as if at school, not to begin with, yeah, but certainly at some point, you actually had found a way to survive. And that was who, yeah, you knew and how you behaved.
You're right, actually. At school, I became a local. What does that mean? I became a youth from Shirley, which was me. It wasn't somebody from the home. It wasn't somebody where I'd come from at Oakley House. It wasn't somebody from the black community. I'd become, one of the lads. I looked up to people on the estate, and I looked up to older kids at school. I'd become, you know, a Brummie as a Birmingham school lad, you know. Do you know what I mean?
Well, you'd become Tony from...
No, I don't think... I'm not. That Tony is not the Tony I know now.
No, no, I don't mean that. But yeah. You'd become an identifiable person.
Yeah, I had.
As opposed to a member of a, I don't know, a subgroup. Whether that's to do with Bernardo's, whether that's to do with your race.
Yeah, and I think that took time to formulate, actually. Because I think when I was at school, I was probably looking at the different groups and trying to understand which group I'd have belonged to. And I felt much more akin to kids who had probably had a bit of a hard time themselves and were, you know, quite stoic and quite not soft. None of them were soft.
And you likewise were not soft.
No, I was much more like them. It's a shame. I didn't have, apart from English, which I personally liked, I don't think I had any academic pleasure coming to the school. In fact, it was a reverse. My homework was constantly marked. You've seen some of it. My writing's disgusting. My effort was pathetic. These sort of things. And I think if you're getting that constantly, you just think, what's the point? So I don't think I even tried to become academic because I wasn't getting it at home. And I certainly wasn't getting it here. So for me, it was a place to come with people and learn all of my social skills. In fact, I probably learnt more social skills at this school that I take into my daily life than anything else. So in that case, it's been very valuable. I quite liked, you know, history, like anything that took me away from where I was. And so I used to read a lot, which is bizarre because the schools say I wasn't academic. But I do remember reading, I must have been the third year at school, we had Animal Farm and I was totally engaged in it. And I remember getting, you know, I don't know, 98 out of 100 on a thing on Animal Farm and the school thinking I must have cheated. And I remember thinking, no, it's because I'm interested in it. Nobody had any academic aspirations for me. But to be fair, I didn't have the emotional capacity to have them for myself. I was just surviving. Do you know what I mean? I was surviving in the house I was living in and trying to survive in that bear pit of a school and trying to deal with race, dealing with aggro. You know, in 1977, 78, 79, the National Front and marching in Birmingham, in Solihull, where I live and everywhere. So that was my reality. It wasn't just an add-on, because if I'm the only black person in the school, which I was, and people are talking about the National Front, 10, 15% of the school are talking about me, whether I like it or not. Do you know what I mean? Those are just the people I know. That focuses the mind a bit.
And were there National Front members at your school?
Of course. I knew most of them. Yeah. At this stage, race was becoming a major issue. When I arrived at Wildmoor Road, I was the first child of colour. By the time I left, there were still only three of us.
The thing was that Birmingham, to us, was down there. It was down the road. We weren't part of that. Everybody around was white, whether it was school children or shopkeepers. You know, there were no Indian restaurants. There were no anything of any other colour, only white. So, of course, I often thought afterwards, was it really wise to have placed these three children in the area that they were dropped into? Because they had no one to whom to relate at all. Now, if those three had been placed in a home somewhere, say, in the centre of Birmingham, that might have been a different scenario.
And was race an issue for you?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it was the defining issue. You know, I remember going on holiday. I remember going into towns and villages in and around Essex or Colchester, wherever it was, and people would just look at us as curiosities.
Yeah.
And so if you are constantly looked at as a curiosity, you just have to redefine and ask yourself why, and it just wears you down after a bit, I think. And so for me, I was defined by it. I was always Tony, you know, the black kid.
But don't you think that ordinary black families with black kids in those days were still, if they went to the seaside, to somewhere where black people didn't normally go on holiday or whatever, they were just as much a spectacle as you were.
Yeah, but the difference is, you've said the families, so when they got home at night, their mother or father would give them a sense of perspective.
Yeah.
As you said, you weren't trained to do that.
No.
But if you don't have that anchor point, you're like a piece of tumbleweed running, really, and you have to put your own anchor down. I remember the day Muhammad Ali died, and I was quite shocked. I was surprised how upset I was, and I had to think, why am I this upset? And it's because at that age, the only positive role model I had of anybody of colour was Muhammad Ali, and he was the only male black figure who my friends respected, shopkeepers respected, as you said, everybody respected, yeah. Even you or people in the home would say, hey, he's a good-looking man, he's successful, and he's articulate. And so for me, my sense of pride and my sense of emotional well-being would be linked to somebody I didn't know. For me, Muhammad Ali and later Paul Robeson and Sidney Poitier were just the positive role models I needed during this important period of my life. It was a big deal at senior school. That was the defining thing for me, I think.
What, race?
Race, yeah.
How did it manifest itself?
Was it threatening? No, it wasn't threatening at all. I just felt a bit worthless. When you talk about institutionalised racism and people talk about lived experience, I felt all of that and I knew what all of it was. So I've got Barnardo's and Wedmore Road referring to, he doesn't seem to be bothered about his colour on a regular basis. I've got my teachers in my school report saying, you know, he doesn't seem to be bothered about his colour. We've got the prevalence of the British movement, National Front, you know, all these people coming through in the newspapers, which were the red tops in those days. And you've got this fashionable thing for young working class boys to be, yeah, I'm in the National Front, but Tone's all right. It's not you, mate. It's the others. That was my reality. And then on top of that, people would think it was totally okay for my nickname to be Sam. For ages, people just called me Sam.
Sorry, so you were Sam all the way through school?
Yeah.
To your friends?
I think so, yeah. That's not good, is it? No, was it? Here's the thing. I've met a lot of them since then, and everyone calls me Tony now. So I know that they know. You know, I feel a bit of shame, actually, telling you this, you know, but when I was at school, yeah, I was known as Sam. As in Sambo, for those who don't know. You know when people talk about it and laughs and stuff like that? For me, it wasn't funny, because it's a throwaway line. Oh, do you remember, Tony? Oh, yeah, right, OK. Do you know what I mean? And it's nobody's fault, Paul. It's just, you know, England was a pretty shitty place. You know, but at the time, also, you have to remember, this was a time when the National Front, British movement were going. And around here, actually, was quite a big recruiting ground for that. So I went to school with people who would say, oh, yeah, I'm in the National Front, which they genuinely were. But it's not you, Tony, you're OK. Not about you, so don't take it personally. Which genuinely people hand on heart would say to me regularly. It was just, I could have chosen to wear that as a problem, but I just chose to ignore it. In a forgiving way, in a weird way. I didn't judge people by it. Because actually, I understood the mindset they were coming from. A lot of people who said they joined those organisations weren't actually overtly racist. They were growing up themselves in a working class area that was now experimenting with their own sense of self and their own sense of where they were in the world, and were just taken along by it.
One question, when you were here and you were the only, mm-hmm. or certainly the first black child, were you known as Tony
or
the black kid?
No, I was known as Tony for the very reason that I was probably the only black kid. A lot of the racism was from some of the teachers, to be honest, and you've seen the reports. Being the first, anyone who had a problem with that would have been very comfortable to communicate the fact that you've got a problem with it. So there were no professional barriers. When I mentioned to the deputy head about, you know, my reports starting that Tony's a typical West Indian, he was visibly shocked. I'm not here about that. It's not about challenging anyone. It was just how it was.
And presumably continued to be.
Continued to be, yeah, yeah. I never went out with any girls at school. Not because, I'm sure maybe they might have liked me, but I was so institutionalised about race. Any girl I liked, I thought, I'm not going to go out with you because I don't want other people to call you names. That's terrible. But that honestly was my reality. And that was terrible for me as an adult to think that now. I just gave up any thought of having a girlfriend. People were quite nasty, and I wouldn't want anybody I liked being called names. So I've had no positive sense of self around what I looked like or the community I came from, because I saw no positivity around it. So that as a backdrop for everything I'm doing was why I was a bit miserable, really. Yeah. You know, during the school curriculum, we were reading books like A Taste of Honey which, if you know the book, is about a young black sailor who marries a young girl from Nottingham and she comes pregnant. It was all really negative reinforcements of what it was like to be a working class white girl, to go out with somebody of colour. And I didn't want to be that person, and I didn't want that narrative for somebody I liked either. So I wouldn't go to a disco and dance with somebody or ask them out or try and kiss them, because I thought, yeah, it'd be too bad for them.
But that leaves you in an isolated, lonely position.
Yeah, but I was, so I didn't lose anything. Yeah, I was, yeah. But I didn't have an expectation of anything else, to be honest. It just seemed a bad thing for me to do. You know, it sounds terrible, doesn't it? Done that to somebody, that's awful to have to admit that. But that's a reality. So when people talk what race, institutionalised racism means, that there is institutionalised racism. I didn't feel comfortable enough about putting somebody else in that position. And to this day, it affects me, actually, Paul. You know, sometimes I will revert back. You know, if I'm out walking with my wife in the street, she wants to hold my hand, sometimes I'll be like, oh, no. And she'll probably think, gosh, you're not very tactile, but I'm actually defaulting to then. Does that make sense? Think, I wonder what people will think in a car when they drove past. That still comes from that time.
And were you aware that this is the sort of stuff that Tony was wrestling with at the time when you were with him?
I don't think so, because I don't know that it's an awareness, you know, as a white person, really, that you can have. We can never know. You know, it's a bit like saying to somebody who's just lost their husband, oh, I know exactly how you feel. You've no idea how they feel.
Yeah.
And I think it's that same sort of scenario, really.
Much of this lived experience you won't find in the school reports or the papers compiled and held by Bernardo's. Their value is that they act as reminders and prompts, sometimes insightful, but in many cases just wrong.
It's 1975. It says here, has black girlfriend.
Yeah, well, it's not true at all.
Tony is very English in culture.
Is that what it says? It wasn't my girlfriend either. She was going out with Phil Clark, who was a white boy who lived in a home, but they couldn't quite understand. If I went out with me, Phil and her, it had to be my girlfriend. God, it's... Do you know what, Paul? This is terrible. I'm going to tell you something. I was quite rough when I was a kid. She used to go to Pitmaston School, and Pitmaston School was a tough school in South Birmingham, and she had a lot of aggro at school. So Phil said, right, we're going to go down and sort this out for her. So me and Phil sat on the school wall as the whole school came out, with three broken milk bottles each, and every single lad that came out just wouldn't even look us in the eye. The whole school. Phil was also in the home with me as well. But that's my point. He just had nothing to lose. And at the time, that's when my head was, I could be this guy or I could be that guy. But how bad could my life have gone then if something had happened and somebody lost an eye or something? Do you know what I mean? I could have spent 15 years in jail, come out, and been a totally different person. I was in that world, but I was me. It was like I was living in a film. And I desperately didn't want it to be me, but I had nowhere else to go. They were just people I grew up with. It's like sliding doors sometimes, but that's true. True story, that happened.
Still presents as a charming young man, though he will now say that his joking manner is a defence.
What year is this?
This is 1976.
Okay.
He believes himself to be a shy, serious person underneath. He shows a high degree of awareness of his own and other people's feelings. Still popular with boys and girls, though worries what the latter's fathers will say. He thinks of himself as white unconsciously, but does not deny his colour and the associated problems.
Oh, that's pretty apt, isn't it, in terms of what I've just been talking about?
And also what strikes me is these seem to be reports that do seem to get
a
handle on who you are and what you're coping with.
Yeah.
And would you agree that even with the colour?
What, sees himself as white?
As unconsciously white.
Of course, because that's how I grew up. I couldn't be anything but, because if I was anything but, I'd have had a mental breakdown, because I can't take on a whole society. I was born, raised, educated, religiously, culturally, TV, school, white. And that's all I could be. In the hot summer of 1977, I finally left school. I never went back to pick up my results, or even my artwork, of which I was quite proud. This recent visit with Paul was only the second time I'd been back. I was in an environment where the default was, I think by most people, they'd have probably hated to have been me. Nobody would have wanted to be black in those days at all, including myself, probably deep down, because I had no sense of pride or no sense of positive reaffirmation of who I was or what I was. And so these are the things I was dealing with. So school was just a place I went to from 8:30 till 3 o'clock. So therefore, asking me how I was doing there, what my reports were, I think, is frankly absurd. I am just barely clinging on. That's what it was like.
And then you go home to Wildmoor Road and it isn't wildly different.
No, it's not at all. No, it was just hanging on. It was an emotional endurance. That's what it was. It was emotional endurance that I was dealing with then. And I don't have a better way to describe it other than being miserable. You just have to close down and play the long game, not even knowing whether the long game's going to come. The strength is doing that. We can all say, gosh, I'm going to be in prison for 15 years and I know I'm coming out on the 29th of whatever in 10 years' time. It's trying to do that knowing that there will never be a release date and trying to hold it together. That is the skill. Not skill. That is what I had to deal with. Yeah. And I think that is what, in many ways, I'm quite proud of. I left Wildmoor Road to go and live with foster parents. And this visit with Paul was only the second time I had returned since I walked out the front door in 1975.
Did you have to leave here to become yourself more?
Yeah. I think if I'd have stayed here, there's a sense of depression just even looking at the building. I think I'd have still had that. I had to, yeah. But that's the bit, you know, where you talk about knowing yourself, really. I had to then, over a period of four or five years, refocus and reshape on becoming the person that I knew I was, as opposed to the person everybody thought I was. I tell you what it is, Paul. I feel I know myself enough not to have to be something that I'm not. And I know who I am, so I don't need to be something I think people should think I am.
And when did you get that?
I think part of this growing up and going through forced me to do this. I don't think I got that until I was probably in my 40s, really. And that was through, you know, just a lot of self-awareness, therapy, career, relationships, patience, having my own children, travelling, a combination of all of those things. You know, I lived abroad for 8 years in an environment where race wasn't the issue, religion was. So suddenly I was not part of a marginalised group. So I could learn who I was in that environment and actually have a 360 on myself, which was really useful.
But the groundwork for getting there, that started while you were at Wildmoor Road.
Yeah, it did, because I think I just had a perfect storm of, you know, there was a rejection going on. I was in a world where I was the oldest of all the children of colour in the home, which made a difference. I was a pioneer in as many ways. I was the first black child in my infant, junior and senior school. So while I was physically going through all of these steps, I had to mentally process it and have some sense of who I was and what it made me feel. And I couldn't avoid having to have that conversation with myself because I didn't have the luxury of having it with anyone else or anybody giving me a perspective on it. I think it's only since I've been, you know, away from everyone and able to be myself that I'm me. And so half my life's been now accommodating people's perception of me in a way that doesn't offend them. I would try and be what they thought I was to make them feel comfortable, rather than alienating what they thought I was, because otherwise they might just think, oh, I don't know, it's a difficult one. There was no unconditional with anyone, so I would conditionally be what they thought they wanted I was.
And when did you stop doing that? Or have you stopped doing
that? Yeah, no, interesting.
That's an unfair question.
No, it's not. It's not an unfair question, actually.
Have you?
I'm just saying, is it an unfair question? No, yeah, I think so. But, I mean, we're all human, so perhaps we all have an element of that. But I think for me, to be myself and be happy, I couldn't do this programme if I hadn't. So I guess so. Does that make sense?
So, but only recently in that case. By recently, I mean in the last few years.
Yeah.
It wasn't that you left Wildmoor Road and then became the real Tony. It took a while.
Oh, yeah. It took 10, 15 years. 20 years. You've been listening to Resilience, A Life in Care. For more information about Barnardo's Oral History Project, visit the website at www.barnardos.org.uk/oral history. In the next episode, I start that journey and I enter the world of work.
Do you know what the one building we should go and visit? I like carpets. Well, I spent 5 years as a porter.
And the world of music. One of the things that changed everything is the whole two-tone movement, what happened in Birmingham. And I surf that. But before I go, I want to leave the last word to Jill Harrison, the one person that throughout the years of this programme was always there for me.
How different was the Tony that left to the Tony that you saw that first time?
He'd grown up. He'd grown up from a 10-year-old kid to a young man. The Tony I saw when he left me was a young man going out into the world, starting work, as opposed to the child I took on when I first started.
And the Tony that's here now in front of you?
In a pain in the neck, but other than that, yeah.